It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys of law, the right advice at the right time, and Wes Collins is with us. Good morning, Wes.
Good morning, Ben.
And if people would like to call in with a question, 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. So what are we talking about today?
Well, Cecil's out today. His daughter graduated from Wake Forest.
So
he's up there. I think that she was right at the top of her class too, and just really a great student.
You know,
great girl going forward. So
I remember his daughter coming in here sometime in elementary school.
I know. Don't tell me that, because my kids are 11 and 12 now. It's like, wow, what happened?
They were born while we were doing this show.
That's right. It's unbelievable. So yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the requirements and limitations that the laws of the state of North Carolina impose upon medical malpractice cases.
Okay. All right.
Your typical negligence case, like a car accident case, that type thing. You know, there aren't all these statutory restrictions placed on those type cases.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get into, pointing at a medical provider, a medical doctor, with regard to liability, with regard to potentially malpractice, then, basically this is an insurance related issue. The insurance lobby is very strong and has pushed through over the years a lot of, different restrictions that we have to deal with before these type lawsuits can be filed.
Right. Okay.
So let's start with the statute of limitations, because Ben, that's really where we start with any kind of case. We want to make sure that our listeners know the time frame for which they would have to bring these type cases, because in the event the time frame is passed, then you have no claim right from the beginning. So the statute of limitations generally in a medical malpractice case is going to be a 3-year statute of limitations, statute of limitation, which would be from the date of the injury. So it would be from the date of the surgery, from the date of fair to diagnose.
Right.
From the date of these type of issues, maybe, what would be another one?
A reaction to a medicine.
Yeah, it could be those kind of things. But normally we see, from the surgery, fair to diagnose, over medication, wrong medication, these kind of things.
Yeah. And I was saying to you before we started, when you mentioned what we were going to talk about, I thought, there might be something in surgery might not notice for 5-6 years.
That's right. So the 3 years is where we start. And then there are some other limitations that we deal with where it extends this out a little bit in dealing with the things that you just brought up. It's a 1-year statute of limitations from the date that the injury is discovered.
Okay.
So that changes things a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that only limits it out to 4 years from the date, let's say, of the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you discovered that something was done wrong, some type of malpractice with regard to a surgery, and it was 3.5 years ago. Well, if you just discovered it, and you just realized that maybe your doctor has indicated, oh, I see that this was done wrong.
Yeah.
Well, then you would have 6 more months in order to bring that action, because it's basically a 1 year from discovery, but 4 year kind of like statute of repose type limitation.
Okay. From the date of the event that may have precipitated this particular injury.
That's
right.
So, okay. Yep. The next statute of limitation that we deal with is a 1 year after the date of discovery, if an object is left inside someone.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The sponge case.
Yeah.
That type thing. But that's also a 10-year type statute of repose as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if we learn at some time, well beyond the surgery, that something was left inside the body, we learn that at a later date, then we have 1 year to bring a lawsuit from the date that we learned of that. But it can't be more than 10 years from the date of the actual surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, to recap, it's 3 years off the top, and then 1 year from discovery with a 4-year cap on that, and then 1 year for items left in the body from discovery, but a cap of 10 years on that. So those are the statute of limitations that we deal with. and they fall within, you know, their own set of statutes in dealing with medical malpractice cases. So the next place that we should move to, I think, is as it relates to what we refer to as the 9J requirements. And basically what that is that you can't, if you just think that the doctor messed up,
right,
you can't file the lawsuit just because you think they messed up.
Yeah.
Even if it's pretty obvious. I mean, you could file it, but it's going to get dismissed. You have to have a medical expert provide what's called a 9J report, a report where that witness has examined the medical records and has made a determination that there was, in fact, a breach of the standard of care. Now, that in and of itself sometimes is a complicated part of the file. In many cases, when I'm representing a client in cases like this, the first part of the file is, you know, really just locating the correct 9J expert and getting the 9J expert to evaluate all the medical records. In many cases, they're very voluminous, thousands of pages or hundreds or thousands of pages. And discussing the case with the expert, making a determination as to whether there was a breach of the standard of care. And sometimes it seems like there was clearly a breach of the standard of care, and the expert's opinion is that there wasn't. I mean, it's not as though if you have a bad outcome, that's necessarily a breach of the standard of care.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes it just doesn't work.
That's right. It's not a guarantee when you go into the surgery that it's, that it's going to work or going to be successful. So that's a big part of the case.
Now, and we have come to expect an awful lot sometimes from our doctors, really.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
So, you know, last week we talked a little bit about attorney fee structure. Now, this is an interesting part of these type cases as well. In many situations, the client will hire the attorney and pay the attorney, let's say, an hourly rate to do what work is necessary to seek the 9J expert opinion.
Right, to get to the point where you might file.
Exactly. And then in the event that the 9J opinion comes back that there is, in fact, a breach of the standard of care and we're proceeding with a civil action for medical malpractice, then that normally falls within a contingency. So in the event that there's a recovery, then the attorney fee would usually be something like a third, sometimes 25%, sometimes higher, just depending on the circumstances. So that's the way that works. Now, also, when we're dealing with medical malpractice cases, there is a little bit of a different type of burden of proof for emergency room cases.
Right.
Okay. Our General Assembly has basically focused in on, okay, you know, it's a hotbed. There is it's a situation where things are moving quickly, moving fast. There's a higher likelihood of maybe a mistake. So we're requiring a higher standard. So when we're talking about the typical medical malpractice case, it's just the standard civil standard, which is greater weight of the evidence. Okay. But when we're talking about an ER type situation, let's say the emergency room doctor in whatever, putting in the chest tube, put it in the wrong place and cut an organ or did something here, did something there in the emergency room setting, then that standard is going to be clear and convincing evidence instead of just greater weight of the evidence.
Right.
And what is clear and convincing evidence? Well, normally we think of that instead of being clear greater weight, which is a little bit more than 50%, we think of that being like two-thirds.
Right.
Okay.
Something more egregious.
That's right. Two-thirds is normally what we talk about as far as that goes. So a different standard as we talk about that, and very important to have the 9J expert, and very important to get on that immediately because, you know, sometimes it takes some time for that 9J expert to review everything and to make a determination as to whether there was a breach of the standard of care. Once we have that opinion, then we want to get that opinion in writing.
Right.
And we have to refer to that in the complaint that we file, so that we have basically identified that expert and identified those opinions, and also indicated the expert has reviewed all of the medical records.
Before we take a break, a couple other things real quickly. I would think we can back up a little bit far, as like the ER example. You have Good Samaritan exemptions, don't you? When somebody stops on the side of the road to help somebody who's in a crisis.
Yes. Yeah. There are certain limitations with regard to, those type of issues. Mm-hmm. Your actions have to be pretty gross, egregiously negligent, in order to have liability, with regard to that.
And then the EMTs to respond. You have another standard there, too.
There's another standard with regard to that, yes.
Yeah, so again, you can see when it's urgent, when it's the greater the urgency, the more difficult it would be to prove, I would imagine.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. More to come in a moment here, talking about medical malpractice. Your questions are welcome, too, at 800-818-2255 or these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
Hey, welcome back. Good to have you with us on Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins. And Wes Collins is with us with a very difficult issue of medical malpractice.
Sure. Ben, we were talking about the evidentiary requirements. Just kind of taking a step back and looking at medical malpractice cases in North Carolina, and really, I think, in any state, in order to have a viable claim, and obviously we hope that folks don't get hurt as a result of something that a doctor does. But it happens. Mm-hmm. There are mistakes that happen in the OR and in the ER and the
over goodness! Look at everybody that's involved. You got anesthesiologists and anesthetists, and
things happen, and they just do. But these cases are extraordinarily difficult cases for many reasons, not just these statutory reasons that I'm going through here, but also because there's usually a very strong defense to protect the doctor. It's insurance defense. The insurance is, medical malpractice insurance is providing the defense. There's all the requirements with regard to the expert witnesses. The other side will have expert witnesses as well. There will be a lot of expense as it relates to the cost of the case. And again, back to last week, difference between cost and difference between fees.
Mm-hmm.
Cost or what it costs to pay these experts.
Yep.
What it costs when the experts are being deposed. There could be a necessity of just of more than one expert. There could be an issue with regard to maybe the imaging and also the surgery. So, or the anesthesia as well. I mean, it could be that we need, a radiologist, and we also need, a surgeon of some sort. Mm-hmm. It just depends on what the circumstances are. So, but the best direction that I could give to folks out there who think that they may have a medical malpractice claim, or they think that there was something that was done wrong in a medical context and they're suffering the consequences of that, is just, pay attention to the statute of limitations, the 3 years that I talked about early on, and the 1 year discovery rule, and get to an attorney who deals with these issues within that time frame, and just let talk with the attorney. Most attorneys on these type cases We'll meet with folks free of charge just to evaluate the situation and get some direction on what to do. And that will at least give you peace of mind as it relates to, whether there is a breach of the standard of care, whether it's a case that needs to be looked into more closely or not. And really, the bottom line here is that in many cases, if there was something that was done wrong in a medical context, we're not going to be able to correct that with money. Mm-hmm. We're just not going to be able to do it. But in the event that there is a long-term issue that we're having to deal with, and there at some point in time, there might need to be a higher level of care, like care in the home as a result of something happened. Well, to seek recovery to cover those type things is important, so that obviously we you know, I'm sitting here thinking of cases going through my head, and I don't know which ones I can talk about, to be honest with
you. That's right. Tough. You got to come up with a.
That's right.
An analogy.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, that's a big part of it, you know, as well. So again, get with a good attorney who deals with these issues and have the issues evaluated, early on. And it could be that there's a claim, could be there's worth looking into, could be it's not worth looking into.
Now, you mentioned kind of at the beginning, this is a far different, standard or set of standards than product liability, for example.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. You don't have all of these evidentiary requirements in a product liability case.
Mm-hmm.
You usually don't have the defense, you know, that is so staunch as it relates to, you know, defending the doctor or defending the hospital or defending the personnel at the hospital. So yeah, product liabilities, we evaluate those product liability cases completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk a little bit about some of the caps that the state of North Carolina has put on recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not as though, you know, if you go to court and you win and the jury says you get $1 billion, that you get $1 billion.
Right.
Because our General Assembly says, nope, we're not going to allow that. We're putting a cap on this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is relatively new in North Carolina. I think the statute came down on that, on the $500,000 cap, in 2011. So basically, we have different types of damages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's talk about that briefly. We have damages that are economic damages, which are things like your medical expenses, your lost wages, those kind of things that we can actually calculate. Those damages would also be, let's say, a life care plan.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say someone is really dramatically injured as a result of a medical malpractice.
Right, and they're going to need care.
They're going to need care.
Right.
So there's another expert we have to bring in, life care planner.
Mm-hmm.
There are those type people out there, and they put together the life care plan and give us a value, a present day value of what the damages would be to provide the life care plan for this individual through their typical life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So these type of damages fall within the economic, damages, type of definition. But then when we get to the non-economic damages, those are more of the subjective type damages, such as pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we all have heard of pain and suffering, right?
Right, right. But those are, again, subjective.
Right. Loss of enjoyment of life, these type things. Now, you know, that's kind of where sometimes the juries go nuts, you know, and they say, well, that the pain and suffering now and for the rest of his life is going to be significant.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the loss of enjoyment of life, he can't go on the boat anymore. He can't play golf anymore. He can't, you know, that's significant. Well, the state of North Carolina has put a limit on that of $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
There cannot be a recovery for more than $500,000 for these non-economic type damages, such as pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life. However, and there's always an exception, it seems like, doesn't it, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
So, however, in the event that it's found that the conduct was reckless, grossly negligent, intentional, or malicious, then that $500,000 cap does not apply.
Hmm.
Now, intentional or malicious, that's going to be very
tough
rare.
Tough one.
I mean, are you ever going to have a doctor, medical provider provide medical services to someone and intentionally hurt them? Probably not, you know, but, when we look at grossly negligent, those kind of things, well, if the doctor shows up drunk and does the surgery, that kind of thing, it happens in the world.
Yeah. So that may happen there. So I will have more to come in a moment here with Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. You can reach us at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. And remember to go online to find them at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back, Aaron. We've got about 4 minutes left as we talk about medical malpractice and those things. And, of course, the state regulations on that, too.
That's right. So we were talking about the limitation on damages, $500,000 limit for the non-economic damages, which are the more of the subjective type damages, such as pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't really calculate that. You can't calculate it as, well, my medical expenses were this,
mm-hmm.
or my lost wages were that, or my life care plan is this.
I'm going to be out of work for.
That's right. It's not that type of thing. The pain and suffering is more of, let's sit back and look at this and think what the value of this guy's not being able to play golf for the rest of his life is.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. You know, so.
Or mobility issues.
Mobility. Right. That was just an example, the golf. But I mean, it could be anything. So the 500,000 cap, is the ceiling on that.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have recovery of more than that for these non-economic type damages. Now, we have a new statute in place. I know we just have a couple of minutes, so we'll wrap up with this. There's a new statute that deals with bifurcating the trials. So in the event that we have a claim for $150,000 or more of damages, could be of any type of damages, then automatically the trial is going to be bifurcated into two different issues.
So one for
liability.
Is
the first issue.
Mm-hmm.
Second issue, damages.
Mm-hmm.
And if the jury comes back on liability, no, we don't get to the second part of the trial. So this is not a choice by the judge. This is not,
is it a separate jury?
Same jury.
Oh.
We try issue number one first, try liability first. And, you know, how does that work? That works where we talk about what happened and we talk about whether there was a breach of the standard of care. We don't talk about how it has affected this person.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So it kind of takes the emotion out of it. It takes the, you know, the dollars and cents issue out of it. It really focuses on one thing.
Just the facts, man.
Was, exactly. Right. Was there a breach of the standard of care?
Mm-hmm.
So then the jury then makes a determination on that issue. And in the event that there's a no, we don't get to the second issue. In the event that yes, there was a breach of the standard of care, then there's a second trial on damages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the evidence comes in as to, you know, the medical expenses, how this has affected the person.
Mm-hmm.
So we can talk about the pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, all these type issues.
Yeah.
So,
some states in criminal law have, separate trials for sentencing. For example.
Yes, they do. So. And we also have a statute as it relates to punitive damages that we've had for a period of time. If we have, you know, a claim that's an underlying claim and we're also seeking punitive damages for that, then that normally is going to be bifurcated as well. You're going to try the first part of it, and then in the event that there's liability, then that same jury hears the issue on punitive or punishment type damage.
Get in touch with Harvell and Collins by giving them a call at 726-9050 at harvellandcollins.com.